Now we're recording. So welcome to ACIC's fourth annual tech policy review for Arizona country. We try to bring a wealth and breadth of speakers to you once a year, early in the year. Legislature is still in session here in Arizona. We found that to be a timely point in the year to be doing. And so, unlike the initial announcement said, our chair, Mike Kellner, is here, but I'm going to go ahead and moderate the last comments during it. And so, we often go around in both the room and remote and introduce everyone, but due to the number of people on the program and the value we hope to that information, we're going to dispense with that today. I know Oris will probably start a sign-in sheet, so we know, and there's quite a number of people on the remote. And thanks to Christopher Smith of Cox for the Chinese fire drill we put him through the last 2 days, figuring out how to record it so that we can post it on the web probably by next week. And people who aren't here today or really want to hold people's feet to the fire about what they have said publicly in this meeting will have a electronic record of
it. Mark?
Mark Goldstein, I'm the secretary to the group and past chair. And we have a number of our chairs and board members, past chairs, board members here. We've also just come off of a 2 day or a day and a half Digital Cities convention that was in Tempe that was very useful. Quite a number of people from ACIC and from government and industry were there. And we consider that a launch event. Steve Peters, I believe, later will talk about a telecom summit that we'll be holding later this year, mid-year. There's flyers on that. We haven't quite set the date, but we kind of consider this W2I was producing organization, their event to have been kind of a warm-up and engagement on some of the especially municipal broadband issues that we're trying to deal with here in Arizona. So that was a great event for us to have come here. We were able to prompt quite a few people in due to our cooperation with them. So,
Mark, it's a little difficult to hear.
Okay. Does it help if I'm in proximity to this particular microphone?
Yes, that's definitely better.
Or this is a remote for those that of our speakers that want to roam.
Yeah.
So good. Sorry. Thanks for the intercession there. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our board member, our good friend and policy champion, Director Chris Comiskey of EITA, Government Information Technology Agency, and the CIO of the state of Arizona, Chris. And I'll offer you a choice that you can either stand near this one or I may need a power on. Take this on.
Mr. Peters, can you hear me in Tucson?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, that's the point then. All right. Everybody, good afternoon, and welcome to today's gathering. As I have participated in past years, I want to thank Mark and Oris and Mike and the leadership of ATIC for really drawing together thought leaders throughout the continuum of technology and innovation into one forum where we can talk intelligently about what's happened in the last year and really where things are headed. And it's always a privilege to share the program with my former colleague in the legislature, Commissioner Hatchmiller, who really was a leading light in the legislature on technology issues and continues to bring that leadership now to the commission. You know, it's kind of interesting when you look at the evolution of things. I got to the legislature in 1991 at the age of 26 and spent 12 years over there. And when I left the legislature, when Governor Napolitano was seated, and she said, I want you to take over this technology agency and act as my policy advisor for innovation, technology, digital government, things of that nature. You know, we were really kind of in this new format where, just as, you know, recovering politicians often say, you know, this is the most important election in your lifetime. You know, it was kind of like that in 2003. You know, this is the most important time ever for the state of Arizona. But you really get the sense that over the last 4 or 5 years that the dynamics have shifted in such a way that we've almost reached a tipping point in that the policymakers, both in the executive and legislative branches, and certainly our fourth branch of government with the commission, really are starting to take the notion that technology and the policy and the business decisions that they make in terms of prioritizations are somehow linked together and inseparable in many ways. And that's kind of a change and a sea change in thinking that has come to be I think because of the work of ATIC and ATC and leadership at the commission and elsewhere, that have really said, you know, you can't separate the technology from this. If you want to have a successful policy agenda, you've got to recognize that these things are embedded into the decision-making process. So we've really tried to do that at the cabinet level, and certainly this starts at the top with us, and Governor Napolitano has really made technology and innovation kind of one of the core embedded areas within the administration. So whether she's talking about education or healthcare or public safety, economic development, there's always this backdrop of where is the technology, what is the innovation angle that we can build on to support the agenda. And you're seeing this nationally as well, because now with the governor serving as the chair of the National Governors Association, she's made Innovation America her signature issue. So she's standing next to this on a national stage, so you can really see her commitment in talking about where she wants things to go, not only for our state, but for the country as a whole. So as the State Technology Agency, we are the recipient of many projects, and we try and keep strategic in our thinking. But I wanted to highlight just a couple of things that I think are endemic as to how state government is viewing things today. And we're trying to be on the front edge of things. I know it's not typical to have government synonymous with innovation, but we're trying to take the best ideas that we can get from the private sector, from people like Ted Craver in education arena, people around the state working on e-health, things of that nature, and saying, let's take those good ideas and use them in a way in which government is an ally and a catalyst for change as opposed to an impediment and a roadblock. And so that's kind of the role that we find ourselves in the State Technology Agency, sitting in kind of a four-way intersection that is anchored by these notions of innovation and policy and technology and strategy. And so how do you blend those together to advance the agenda? And so in so many areas, we've tried to focus our attention in a way that's meaningful and assistive. One way that we're trying to do that is through the Governor's Council for Innovation and Technology. She formed this in 2003. She made a commitment during the campaign, during her first attempt to seek the governorship, that this was going to be a forum for discussing innovation and change. And she's really made it that. When you look at the list of folks this year and last, chaired by Roy Valley from Avnet and Mike Fong at Calence, you really have a group of folks that represent a cross-section of the industry that act as a counsel to the governor on issues of innovation and change. So we've seen a lot of that taking place through the governor's council. One of the areas that we've spent a lot of time within the council is the recognition that if we're going to have a first-class state that is on the right side of this digital divide, then we've got to make sure that we're building infrastructure and doing the things behind the scenes that aren't glamorous, but that have to be there if we're going to have electronic health records or a statewide two-in-one system. And so we're spending a lot of time on the council talking about what kind of infrastructure changes have got to be incumbent with this shift in philosophy. And we've spent a lot of time this last 2 years building on what ATIC has been talking about for 10 years, which is this notion that the private sector is only going to go so far into this deployment of broadband around the state, and then at some point there's going to have to be a partnership between the state and the private sector. And so we've been talking about what's happened around the country with regard to broadband authorities, where does the public to private stop with regard to the state constitution and the gift clause requirements, and where does the possibility of the advent of a broadband authority come into play so that we can incentivize and make the investment in areas that we know the private sector, because there is no return, is recalcitrant or reluctant to invest. And so that's the conversation we're having right now. And one of the things that we want to do is make sure all the stakeholders are at the table to have that dialogue. And I know that Mike Keeling has been instrumental in coming up with some language and working with ATIC and others to give us a footprint. Ron Schott has also been very involved in that, to make sure we've got this general idea, paradigm of where we go with regard to broadband authority and deployment across the state. So in partnership with Jan Lesher, the new Department of Commerce director, we're going to be convening a series of meetings starting next week that hopefully build the foundation that we can get all the stakeholders built around a consensus as to what this thing should be, and then we can bring it forward to policymakers in a way that makes sense and has a value-added proposition that they would want to embrace. So that's one of the main things that are on the table. Wrapped up in all this is certainly the notion of right-of-way. What are we going to do with right-of-way as it relates to incentivizing this process, looking at the executive order that Governor Schwarzenegger issued recently, looking at what other states have done to reduce fees or eliminate barriers that exist to companies coming in and being incentivized to invest around the state because of right-of-way impediments, getting the tribes involved, municipalities, county. You've got all these layers of bureaucracy that really have got to start talking together if we're going to solve some of the barriers that exist out there. So we're excited about the prospect of this, and I would invite all of you in this room to be a party to that conversation. We're going to start that off next week, and it's kind of a conversation in progress because there's so much going on around us, but I think that all of you have a role and a stake to play in that, and so I hope you will participate. Another area I want to focus on just briefly is this notion that e-health has got to be something that we're going to be focusing on in the years ahead. The governor, through executive order in 2005, asked a group of 40 of us to come together, mostly the CEOs of the providers, the payers, the different stakeholders out there in the health space, doctors, hospitals, to come together and talk about building a roadmap for e-health. And all of us have a vested interest in this because each of us is a user of that system. And right now, today, we see, you know, our physicians in different specialties that can't speak to each other. The lab results are one place. The prescription capabilities are another. We need to make sure that the technologies that are available are being ingrained in this change that's coming in healthcare. And so we're spending a lot of time talking about that. And recently, we shifted from the governor's steering committee on e-health, which has been meeting for the last 18 months, and came up with a roadmap, to now a 501c3 that's been established with the hope of the help of the Arizona Medical Association, the Hospital Association, APS, and some other corporate leaders, to stand up a forum for this discussion of where we're going with e-health going forward. And as you would expect, there are a myriad policy initiatives and decisions that need to be made. Technology is just a piece of that. You know, what kind of standards do you have in place for something that's statewide like this? How are you going to plug into what Secretary Leavitt is doing at the federal level? What are initiatives like Say Hi, the Rio equivalent in Tucson and Southern Arizona doing? How are we going to blend all this together in a way that actually is meaningful to the consumer, so that you as a consumer of medical information and a holder of it, the person that controls it, you know, what's an e-prescribed system going to look like? How are we going to secure the lab results and the imaging that would traverse a statewide system such as this? So we've got a lot of things that have got to be overcome to make this happen, but I think that if we don't do nothing and you look at what people are talking about organically, you're going to end up with a system like this in about 10 years anyway. The question is, can we manage this in a way that makes sense and is really something that's a valuable asset to those of us who consume medical services, which is just about everything. So that's something that we're going to be spending a lot of time on in the coming months, and I would just encourage you to pay attention to that. There are different permutations to it. Craig Barrett with Intel has an initiative at the federal level that he's working with BP and Walmart to develop electronic health records for the 2 million employees that work for Intel and Walmart and these other companies. And so we're trying to wheel all this together in a way that everyone, again, is doing this in a collaborative sense so that we don't leave anybody behind or go off on a path that's kind of some kind of a tangent that leads to nowhere. So that's another area that we're excited about. And the last thing I would mention today is the area of security. This is something that obviously is on the minds of my colleagues in state CIO offices around the country. It's something that we are struggling with at the state level because we've got a very decentralized system of 115 agencies, boards, and commissions. But the one thing that has come out of the governor's study group on IT and security and privacy is that we need to have a central point to help agencies comply with legislative mandates, HIPAA requirements, and all the other things that come with security and privacy, but also to make sure that we've got incident response capabilities, that we can go in and help in a fashion that can shut off areas of state government that, as we move to a converged network for voice and data, could potentially infect the entire network of 45,000 users. And so we've been working with Will Pelgrin, who's a leader in this nationally out of the state of New York, to come up with a paradigm for a statewide information security office. And that legislation, Senate Bill 1104, is moving through the process now, and we hope to conduct an assessment of our vulnerabilities over the next 14 months so that we can go back to the legislature in that time frame and say to them, we've examined the enterprise, these are where the vulnerabilities exist, and now this is the series of strategies that we're going to have to invoke if we're serious about protecting consumer personal information and data. And so since the government is one of the largest receptacles of this kind of information, I think you want us doing that because we've got your social security numbers, we've got just about every other sensitive data point that you wouldn't want floating around out there. And since Phoenix continues to be the identity theft capital of the world, as our consultants just reminded us in the business case analysis, we've got to get our act together on this. And so we appreciate the leadership and the thought that's gone into this from ATIC and ATC and others through the years who have really pushed this as an idea that every major enterprise that I know of has already traversed this ground, and so we've got to do it and be smart about it going forward. So I guess the simple message for me is that in my fifth year as the state CIO, I see a lot of promise. We've obviously not moved as swiftly as I would like us to do because you've got so many silos and so many impediments to pulling together a system in which you can really provide better services to the citizen. But we're getting there. We're making some strides because we've got good leadership at the top. We've got a cabinet of agency directors that have gotten the message that technology is not the enemy and that we've got to make sure that the decision-making that they're doing is wedded with the technology in a way that can advance the governor's objectives and the legislature. And so that's what we're all about, and I'm excited to be participating in it. And I just want to thank ATIC again this year and every year that we participate in this. It's just a good forum to be a party to, and we look forward to great things to come. Thank you very much.
Director, do you want to take a few questions?
Sure.
Questions for Director? Yes.
Next week, we are Director Lesher from Commerce and I are convening the conversation with stakeholders, anyone that would like to participate in this, to talk about what it is we're trying to accomplish with regard to a broadband authority and also changes in the GADA, the Greater Arizona Development Authority statute, that would make it clear that that entity is capable of providing public-to-public grant monies, which is a prohibition today. Because GADA was envisioned when Senator Wetton and others of us supported it to incentivize infrastructure investment in rural communities, but telecommunications was never envisioned as part of that critical definition. So that's one of the things.
I believe that will what, be Tuesday morning at 10
That is the 20th at 10, yes.
And if you're on our extended board list, we probably won't push this to 4,000 people on our big public list, but if you're on our extended board list, we'll push out the message and dial in remote participation. So, and Horace, our vice chair, is maintainer of that extended board. Just three or four messages a month, our agendas, our minutes. But if you're not on that list, you want that information about the speed, ask for it.
Something.
Other questions? Sir.
Cover people, the people as.
Yes, the question went to the issue of people being a large part of the issue when it comes to breaches or security problems, and we found that to be the case. We looked at every state, talked to the federal government, and the, you know, 80% of the problem tends to be either lack of awareness, usually lack of awareness or training. They're not sure how to engage in the processes and the standards, and with some maliciousness obviously built into that. And so part of what we're trying to do is stand up the training and awareness piece of this, side by side with the, you know, the CERT capabilities and the incident reporting requirements that aren't in place today, so that we build on a pilot program that we actually did with Homeland Security last year at DES, which received national awards, to talk about educating state employees about these kinds of policies and procedures. So that's very much a part of it.
Any questions on remote for the Director Comiskey? Thank you. So next up, we'd like to welcome back to our podium again Chairman Jeff Hatchmiller of the Corporation Commission. He has also had a career in the legislature, as Director Comiskey mentioned. He used to chair an Internet Study Committee in the mid-90s when the Internet was a lot newer. I don't know if it was any simpler then than it is now. But we've always appreciated his technology wherewithal and helping us as Arizonans move forward. Now he sits at the top of his own branch of government. The Arizona Corporation Commission, by constitution, is a fourth branch of government. And I'd also like to thank him here for the photos he took at our debate for his co-commissioners. He had the best single photo, which was, then became our splash photo for our DVD and other things. So, Commissioner.
I don't know.
Right.
On from this one?
Yes.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing me back here.
to a meeting that I think I first attended probably in 2000, maybe a little bit before 1999. Some of you have been at these ones.
Mark, we can't hear.
Yeah, Mark, we can't hear.
Fine, we're switching his microphone.
Is that better? Or maybe this microphone has been switched off.
It's somewhat better, although a little muted.
Okay, does that work better?
Yeah.
Okay. It was the microphone was switched off. I didn't realize that. My apologies. Again, I'm Jeff Hatchmiller. I'm the chairman of the Arizona Corporation Commission. And those of you from out of state, that's the Public Utility Commission or the Public Service Commission. But in Arizona, it's kind of on steroids because we do securities work. We're the railroad department. We're the Pipeline Safety Division. We do a lot of things. But one of the things that we do is we regulate utilities, and a lot of what we regulate over the years since we were formed in about 1908, we were part of state government when it was territorial government. And, in fact, the seal used by the Arizona Corporation Commission was the same seal used by the territory of Arizona. And then when we became a state, they abandoned the territorial seal, and we took it over. So been around a long time, and even back then we were looking at telephone companies, and it really was plain old telephone service. It was a very different world, obviously. In 1912, 1914, yesterday, by the way, was Statehood Day, the 95th birthday of the state of Arizona. We're all, hopefully you'll all join. we'll all join the effort to have some great celebration of our 100th birthday just 5 years from now. I have been involved. The director talked about our early involvement, and when he and I were working on these issues, and I believe it was Secretary of State Betsy Bayless at the time, you had to have a wet signature on every document. We had to go in and change all the laws, all the statutes in the state of Arizona to allow for electronic commerce. It was the whole system was set up to basically deny the use of the Internet, of some digital images, digital signatures as a way to conduct business. And now I don't even know how to use my fax machine anymore. How many people still use a fax a lot? There's a couple in here, but, boy, you're the dinosaurs now. Most people are going to BlackBerry. I think we're going to be signing right off the BlackBerry. So it's a new world, and we have played a part in that, Chris, a small part. And really, the commission's role is to regulate telecommunications companies, but not to regulate broadband or not to regulate VoIP or not to regulate a lot of other things that this group is interested in and the commission is interested in. We're worried about issues like competition. We very strongly believe as a commission that the telecommunications industry ought to be competitive. And so we watch for competitive issues. For example, there's a desire. It used to be that there was a requirement to serve in terms of telecommunications. Now it's if you're motivated to serve, that's the key. And it appears that our larger telecommunications providers, telephone service, but obviously most of them are going for a quadruple play eventually. But just if we just start with a dial tone, most of the people that have a dial tone, they're going to take into an area. Those big companies, whether it's Quest or Cox or others, they're picking and choosing where they go into, and they want to be the preferred provider in the new developments, whether that's an Anthem or a Verado or down in Maricopa. They want to be able to come in. And so what is the commission's role? The commission's role there more than anything else is to ensure that the aspect of competition remains so that all the different players have a chance to participate in that marketplace. We had one incident where a trench was opened and the preferred provider laid their wire or fiber in this particular case, and then the trench was guarded, as a secret, and that was the only way into town, so to speak. And so the other providers were blocked from participation in that particular development. Well, we had to bring in the participants, the developer and the preferred provider, and say, no, you can't. That's not the way it works. You have to open up this trench to everybody. You have to provide an access. Can't charge a prohibitive amount for that access. Those are the kinds of things that we work on. Another area we've been working on lately is virtual networks. VNXX is the term that we use. It has a lot to do with things like inter-carrier compensation for call origination and call termination. I was in Mexico not too long ago, and I called my wife from way down south of Mexico City. Well, my call to her originated in Tucson, and I had to go through quite of a process of talking to people in telecommunications. Are we still on? Not yet.
Oh, okay.
Talking to people in telecommunications to understand how that call leaped from Cuernavaca, Mexico, into Tucson to become originate. It was a call originated in terms of what we're concerned in Tucson. Well, so, you know, then it's not an international long-distance call because it's jumped by via fiber or satellite to Tucson. It becomes a national call. And a lot of people are doing that. They're leapfrogging states. And so we're trying to work out how do you – if you call somebody from Philadelphia in Tempe, is that an interstate call, even though it jumps past most of the traditional interstate network? We're trying to figure that out. And obviously all the providers want to have a common solution for that as well. And then another thing that we work on a lot is the Universal Service Fund. We believe that Arizona is one of those, well, it's not unique, but it's that intermountain reality in the United States is that there's a lot of open space. And there's areas like Phoenix, which are fairly densely populated, and then there are areas like Window Rock, which are very dispersed, or Tuba City, or Page, or Ash Fork, or Seligman, or lots of places, and Cochise is another. So you think about it and you go, well, it's a real different thing to provide a service to somebody on the west side of the White Tank Mountains out here than it is in Sun City. And there's a real difference in cost. And so the Universal Service Fund has been set up so that there's monies to be able to provide a subsidy to people that provide telecommunications. It used to be plain old telephone service. Now it's broadband service as well in these remote areas. And so that's what that Universal Service Fund does. And we pretty much manage that process in Arizona. That's what the commission does. Now let me tell you a little bit about what I do because, you know, quite frankly, the commission is blocked from a lot of involvement in broadband. Very interested in it. The fiber network in the state, very interested in it. Don't have any authority, no legal authority. A lot of things. I've been watching competition, though, because most of what the decisions we've made are based upon a competitive model. And so to make it work the way we're thinking, things have to be fairly competitive. A lot of providers, a lot of market entry. But let me show you what I've been seeing lately, if I can find it on this computer. I guess I'll just have to touch this again. And it will come up, and then I come over here and touch this. Let me show you what I've been looking at lately. And I'll stand over here, and you can see it on the screen. And I can't show you all the slides because we don't really have time. But most of you remember Ma Bell. You know, I love Ma Bell. I grew up on a farm and a ranch, you know, and got a new telephone every 10 years, and it was great. And I can remember when the Princess phone came, and that was a big day in my life. And then, well, it was. Come on, it wasn't it. Some of you remember that, okay? That was a big day. Well, then obviously the federal government got concerned about the monopolistic structure of Ma Bell, and so they broke it up, right? And here's the divestiture, 1982. And you can see, obviously, and I don't know, I probably have a laser here, but you got the PAC system, you got the mountainous system. It just goes on and on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, well, I'd say, what, 7 systems there? 6 systems, 7 systems, depends upon kind of how you look at it, but 7 systems. And so this is what we started with in 1982, and this is what I follow. So I go, okay, well, oh, wait a minute, 2005, we've lost a few of them. You know, a couple of them went away. You can see they consolidated. Quest came in, there's some consolidation there. So if you look at this, you can see how things start to combine. And then now, you know, as you go through it, we have certain areas. We have the SBC and AT&T, and we have the Quest territories, and then we have SBC, AT&T again. We have Bell South, and then we have Verizon. And then, that just changed. It went from, we had SBC, AT&T, Bell South now, and then Quest and Verizon. Well, Verizon didn't like, you remember the Universal Service Center? Verizon didn't like that northeast area. It's very dense, sparsely populated, so they got rid of that. Basically, I think that's Telephone Canada now. I'm not sure really, you know, how that works. But really, you think of it. Nova Scotia, it fits right up there. If you've been in Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire, you kind of get the idea. So that's split up. And so now you got to think of, you know, this is kind of where we are. Well, we're starting to try to think ahead, and where's it going to go from here? And obviously, we're mainly interested in Quest because we regulate Quest. And so we're watching their activities. We watch how they operate, what they do, their decision-making. And so, come back. And we realize that that Quest is in this Intermountain region, and you can tell the difference in densities as you go to the providers on the east and west coast. We have this kind of sparsely populated area that's hard to serve, and real easy to serve Phoenix, but hard to serve Ashport, that kind of a thing. So we keep that in mind, and we start looking at what we can expect here. We're expecting that, and it's already happening, you're going to see some cherry picking going on by the major players. They're going to come into specific marketplaces where there's high density. They're not going to go into the rural areas. They're going to come into the high density areas, and they're going to start to compete for market share in the choicest locations, especially in the Quest area, but especially in the mid part of the country. And you start to think about, well, what if who's going to eventually buy Quest? We think that Quest probably will be for sale. So we look at, well, who's going to buy? Well, think about what if Verizon bought Quest? Okay, I think they'd only buy major areas. I don't think they'd want to buy all of Quest. I think that would probably be the deal. They'd come into certain areas. They certainly want the western Oregon, Washington, the Pacific areas. They probably like Colorado. They want us, of course. Minnesota sounds good to them, kind of to develop that. What they're looking for is these areas of continuity. And you can kind of see this Pacific states, and then down through the Southwest is one area, and the Midwest into the East, that's kind of another area. Those kind of natural areas to bring together. And let me go past that one, get rid of that one. I'll go to here. We think it's going to eventually come to it. There's going to be some purchases of certain states, and they're going to have purchases of certain key areas or domination of certain key areas. This is kind of the expectation eventually of the alignment, which you'll find a Verizon in the Northeast and the Midwest, and you'll see an AT&T in most of the remainder of the country, and a lot of our Universal Service Fund supported rural providers in the old Quest territories in South and North Dakota and the like. We eventually see an acquisition by Verizon down of some of the states down in the to the southeast as well. And these areas are going to be the ones that are going to be the most difficult to continue to provide for. These will be the problem areas. The rest of them will probably be owned by one major provider. That's kind of our take of where things are going. In other words, we're seeing through a process of consolidation. Our best look in the future is a process of consolidation will return us to two dominant players. Instead of having one, there'll be two. And they'll be blocked from further consolidation by antitrust laws. And at some point in time, they'll kind of make trades of states, some on the East Coast for some on the West Coast and vice versa. We're seeing somewhat the same thing in the wireless industry, the cell phone industry. If you look at the dominant players, and there's four dominant players, two not quite as dominant, weakest of the dominant, Sprint, at the present time. I hope you don't work for Sprint. You probably don't agree with me, but we see Verizon and AT&T certainly strong. T-Mobile is strong. We see Sprint maybe the next acquisition if we acquire something. But if you look at the list here of who Verizon used to be and who AT&T used to be, you just see a process of these were all, you know, you go back 10 years or 20 years, these were all, each one individually, a legitimate cellular company in the United States. And slowly but surely, they're going through the same process of consolidation. I don't know if we'll see just two, as we probably will see in people that are out there really working on the big money. And I think the big money is everybody's going for the quadruple play. They want to provide you with your telephone service, your broadband service. They want to be your TV provider. They want to be your cell phone provider. They want to provide you everything, one bill, one service call, one point of entry and no point of exit. And so that's kind of what we're looking at. And as we think about that, when I talk to my colleagues in Washington, D.C. and in New York, we're keeping this in mind, that our model of how we act as a commission is based upon a competitive model. And a lot of people still go, well, it's a very competitive marketplace out there, leave it alone. Well, yes, it's a competitive marketplace, but the direction right now is to lack of competitiveness. And, of course, you know, if you're an optimist like I am, about 2045 we expect to see a lot of small providers again. A breakup probably by the federal government of the two big providers and a starting over of the race again. But that's kind of some of the stuff I've been thinking about. I'm also, since Chris brought it up, I'm also serve on the Arizona Telemedicine Council, and we've been providing telemedicine services from the University of Arizona for some time now. But it's really not an Arizona Telemedicine Council. It's kind of like a National Telemedicine Council, and it's really not even that anymore. It's kind of like a World Telemedicine Council, and we're wiring up through broadband connections remote medical facilities with large medical centers like the University Hospital. So someone in Tuba City who is in an automobile accident can have diagnostic equipment used on site with a radiologist in Tucson or Phoenix looking at that patient and that looking at the MRI or whatever it is, the x-rays, remotely and discussing in real time with the medical staff on site what the diagnosis is and what needs to happen. Right now what we're able to do is save really, I would say, millions of dollars every year just in not requiring a helicopter and other kind of flight transport to the major cities. People that traditionally would have been sent for diagnostic purposes now don't need to be sent. Faster treatment means more lives saved, because we find that the worst place to get in an accident in Arizona is in the most rural part of our state. Just don't get in an accident in the middle of I-40 going between Holbrook and Winslow. It's a long time till anybody comes. And the closer you are to a medical center that has direct connection to the University of Arizona Hospital, the surer you are of keeping your life. And so that's what we're working on in Arizona. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Anyone have questions for Chairman Hatchmore?
You might have him mention about the fact that we're also working with Panama and the Yuma Proving Grounds down in Yuma with telemedicine.
Yeah, Ralph, you're absolutely right. There's a lot going on, isn't there? It's just it's kind of amazing. We as a commission, though, will continue to be engaged. The FCC and the Congress don't want us to play in certain areas, and that's fine with us. But we will certainly be engaged throughout the state. Anything else? Mr. Campbell? That's probably true. You know, my door's always open.
Tom Campbell recluses himself.
My door's always open to you, and I'd welcome any of your questions directly or personally. Yes.
Could you discuss a little more about broadband over power lines?
Well, we're looking, you know, I guess that was an answer. We were meeting with the Navajo Nation Telecommunications Commission, and we were talking about how do you serve areas like the Hualapai Reservation and the Navajo Reservation. It's a long ways from here. It's not a very desirable place to serve. Do you do it with wire and fiber? Do you do it with satellite? Do you do it? And one of the possibilities is that's still being evaluated is broadband over power lines. And clearly we need to leave the options open. Instead of, government tends to have a way of kind of picking the winners really early and putting all the money into the perceived winner. And usually that's not the best. It's not that it's not the best technology, but it isn't necessarily the best technology. And so this commission at least is really broad in our scope. So we develop a list. We want everybody that could possibly provide a solution on that list. And so broadband over power line is one of those solutions.
Any questions on remote for Commissioner Chairman Hatchmiller? Sorry.
Soon to be.
When is your term as chairman up?
It was up in that.
Ah, okay. Sorry.
No, they are keeping me on. We have to make a change. We have a kind of public post term here, so we have to make new nominations.
Thank you. Thanks for your leadership and joining us again today. So we have Chris Pearson on the agenda next, and he is here in the back of the room. I do see him. Great. So Dr. Pearson is an attorney with Lewis & Rocha and quite a distinguished practice and focus in computer security, cybersecurity issues. He's also the chair or president of the InfraGuard chapter, the FBI InfraGuard chapter here in Phoenix. And he's going to talk to us about some national cybersecurity issues. But did he just walk out of the room a moment with the chairman? Okay, this is where they have the stretch. Mike, do you want to say a few words? Then you had asked to speak on the broadband authority briefly.
Thank you, Mark, and good afternoon, everyone. I did ask Mark a little earlier that I could spend a minute or two speaking with regard to a bill that we had floated in this session, but which we had asked to be truncated. I just came from a meeting where we did that. And the reason for that truncation of the bill, now it's a dead bill, is that we did not build coalitions to the extent that we could have, should have. And so lesson learned, and we've known coalitions are very important. ATIC is built on coalitions as in a general sense, but very specifically with regard to the broadband development authority, an Arizona broadband development authority, and Chris Director Kaminsky talked about a public-private partnership. And that we can only go so far with private investment of broadband within Arizona, and there's still a significant part of Arizona that doesn't have adequate broadband. And so what the bill addressed was a scheme, an approach for public-private partnership. We found that we didn't have enough partners for that partnership to go forward in the legislature this session, and so we've decided to come back and build that coalition. I would encourage everyone in the room to be aware of that, to work on that issue, because I think indeed, as we look throughout the state, we've got by various estimates, a half a million, or so citizens that not only don't have broadband, but don't have broadband coming by their home. Or within reach, and so satellite's about the only approach for broadband that, for that group of folks. It affects the community negatively. We want to start talking about digital inclusion, the solution, rather than digital divide, the problem. And we want to talk about how to bring about solutions. And so, so even though I'm personally a little disappointed about what we had to do with regard to the bill this year, I am very optimistic that we can build those coalitions. We can build a consensus of thought and actions, and whether that comes together legislatively or that comes from out of the governor's office, an executive order, we want to be open to, but we want to build that coalition. We want to make it, give it structure, give it life, and start providing broadband more universally throughout the state. So that's a thought on the bill this year, Mark.
And next Tuesday morning's teleconference and physical meeting will be another step in the re-engagement of that process. So again, if you want to keep aware of that level, that granularity of policy engagement, again, let Oris add you if you're not already on the extended board list. And so I think Chris is still out in the hallway jamming with the CIO and commissioner. So let me bring up Ron Schott, who is next on our agenda. Ron is the executive emeritus of the Tech Council, had a distinguished career with AOL and IBM and much of that in Tucson, and for a while had the great title. What was your knowledge title at the Tech Council? What was that one, Ron? Thought Leadership was his title, which I always thought was a great title. The Tech Council is our partner, is a major state player in technology advocacy and networking connection. Our agenda, though, in telecom, though reinforced by the Tech Council, is often not at the top of the more broad economic development agenda, but here to tell you a bit more about that that agenda and those initiatives, Ron Schott.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Mike, and ATIC, and everybody that is here, and everybody that's on remote. As Mark mentioned, the Arizona Technology Council, it is a private nonprofit, and our goal and objective is to promote the technology industry and technology-based education in Arizona. Anything we can do along those lines to help move the state forward, and we do have a state focus. We are not subsidized by any governmental agency at the current time. We get our funds from our membership, from our events, and from our magazine that we publish. In the magazine, there's some copies of it up here for those of you who don't have it. And it's also on our website. It's called Tech Connect. And this year we hope to have it out four times a year. And it talks about, not the Technology Council, but it talks about what's happening in the technology industry in Arizona. So feel free to pick up a copy, or you can always get the most current issue on our website. I want to talk about what the council. There's an Arizona Technology Council Foundation, which is a 501c3 that does philanthropic type activities, but the Tech Council itself is a 501c6, which allows us to do advocacy and lobbying. And I'm very happy to thank everybody, both the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the citizens and the companies that have been part of the Arizona Technology Council and all their support to help us over the last two legislative sessions to achieve more effective passage of bills than has occurred in the last 10, 15 years in Arizona. Everything from just reducing business property taxes for all businesses that have the certain tax applied to them over a period of time, the providing capital and capital formation for companies, small companies, entrepreneurs. We've run into many companies that say, you know, I really love Arizona. I'm looking for money. I've already maxed out credit cards, you know, multiple mortgages, friends, family, and all that, and I need more money. But, you know, the VCs, there's not that many here in town. Where can I get some capital? Well, we went forward and was one of our main initiatives in 2005 to put forth, and it's referred to affectionately as the Angel Investor Tax Credit. And this is one where entrepreneurs and high net worth individuals in the state of Arizona have an incentive to invest in technology in Arizona, and they can get a 30% to 35% tax, state tax credit against their investment over a period of 3 years. And if it's in the bioscience, biotechnology, or in rural Arizona, they get a extra bonus. They get a 35%. So they get 12, 12, 11 as opposed to 10, 10, 10. The companies that take advantage of this investment, they have to be certified by the Arizona Department of Commerce, and they actually have a streamlined process to do that. This bill went into effect July 1st, and by the end of the year, they had over 30 companies certified. And the people that do the investment, they actually get the investment. When they say, I want to invest in that company, they actually get their tax credit set aside for them so they know it's there. We asked the legislature to, we capped this at $20 million. We also put a sunset clause in that said, after 5 years, if we have not utilized those funds and tax credits, then it goes back to the general fund. We think we have to be good stewards of the funds and the monies that
We ask the legislature to let us try to incent and help grow certain business and industries. One of the other bills that we were able to get passed was the sales factor. We had an anomaly in my terminology in the state where we were disincenting the manufacturers who actually manufactured product in the state and shipped it out of state. And because of the sales factor that we got passed, companies like Intel committed a $3 billion development expansion in Arizona to put a 300 millimeter semiconductor manufacturing facility here after they had already upgraded their existing one for another $2 million. And just the $2 million investment that they put in to upgrade their 150 to 300 millimeter generated over 2,200 high-tech jobs. So we think these things are very important. So building on this, and then in the 2006 session, we worked to increase the R&D tax credit in the state of Arizona. Currently in the state of Arizona, the state will give a credit. This is in addition to what usually has existed as on a federal level. We had a state tax credit for the first $2.5 million of investment by companies in research and development. They can get a 20% tax credit, and anything above that, they get an 11%. So we tried to increase both of those by 10 percentage points so that the first $2.5 million worth of investment, they would have gotten a 30% tax state tax credit, and anything over that, they would have gotten a 21%. That would have put the state of Arizona in the unique position of being the best in all the states in the United States. And we were just chomping at the bit, you know, just excited about going to CEOs and saying, okay, you're an international company. How much research and development did you do in your company around the world? And then, oh, gee whiz, do you realize that Arizona has this incentive for you to do more research and development in Arizona? And unfortunately, you have to compromise in when you're doing public policy and those type of things. There's only so much money to be allocated by the legislature for these kind of activities. And there was another bill that was extremely important, and this was the investment in that was being requested. It was original request was $50 million for capital investment. And it ended up being $35 million, so our bill, even though it went through all the committees, never made it out of the budget committee. So we're back at that again this year. We're asking again for an increase in the R&D tax credit as one of our initiatives. And we've broken our efforts this year into things that we are advocating, our advocacy objectives. The R&D tax credit is one of them. We also are supporting, there is a coalition of a 21st Century Competitive Initiative Fund, and this is a continuation of the one that got $35 million last year, and there are several different elements of that, so we're supporting that. We're also supporting Ted Craver, and I'm sure he'll say a few words if he hasn't passed out the information to you already, on the e-learning and trying to improve the educational structure within our state and the content and the actual results. We're also supporting initiatives that promote more highly qualified, passionate math and science teachers. Just as a sidebar, there's a lot of science bowls and science foundations that are going on each year. There was a case where there were students in the state of Arizona, and everybody hears all the negative about all our students in Arizona. Well, I want to tell you a little positive story. There's a group of students that 2 years ago, Arizona did not have a science bowl for middle school. And the students from the state of Arizona went to Texas. And they went there, and this is a competition that is put on by the Department of Energy. And the students in that competition took first place and represented the state of Texas in the nationals. And won first place. The state of Texas said, thank you very much. We really appreciate that. Please don't come back next year. So the next year, 2006, the students went to California. And not only did they take first place in California, they took first place and second place and third and fourth and fifth and went to the nationals and took top honors. So we decided there's some people, some committed people within the state who said, you know, we need to have our own Middle School Science Bowl. And so this year we're going to have our own Science Bowl. It'll be April 21st, and we're all excited about it. We're going to walk before we run. There will only be 16 teams competing. And as soon as they put the word out of that, I believe they got over 30 teams wanting to get into this. And I was very fortunate to have some of these students and one of the teachers at the school that they're affiliated with on the radio program the Tech Council does called Tech Talk. And it was really amazing to see how smart and energized these students were. That's right. It is www.kfhx.org or .com. And so we're having great fun there. Let me get my glasses on so I can get all my items here. How are we doing on time, Mark?
Fine.
Okay. Streamline, one of the other ones that we want to do is streamline and reform the Arizona Job Training Program. And this job training program has been in existence for a number of years, but it's been pretty bureaucratic and cumbersome because some of the features of it. So we are encouraging that program be reformed, streamlined, and reauthorized. And then, you know, the state has a fairly large budget, but if you look at how much of the state budget is allocated directly to incenting technology and technology-related items, it's $250,000. Now, if you look at that in terms of what you can do with $250,000, it's pretty minimal. And we are trying to push and increase that to $2.5 million. So we're trying to get the legislature to crank that up so we can have more investments directly related to helping us improve technology and technology-based education in Arizona, in addition to what Ted Craver and the ESATS folks are doing. So I'll pause here. We also have advisory objectives where we're supporting various things like the P20 Council, the improving of requiring more math and science in our high schools, and improving the education and supporting the broadband Rural Arizona Authority and trying to make that and get that passed. So we're working on that as well. Any questions anybody may have that I can answer? Okay. Oh, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that, yes, we have lots of events. Please go to our website, www.aztechcouncil.org, and check out our events. We have on March the 13th, we have Steve Ballmer coming to Phoenix. Somebody said he only does this about 31. He's only out of the or in the state doing these kind of things like 31 days out of the year, and we're going to have him here in Arizona. So it's called Bite Night, and there's information about it on our website. And we have a few other things. We have Invest Southwest. This is an event that will happen on the 22nd next Thursday. Out at the Four Seasons, and there's 13 companies, highly qualified companies that are.
Which I believe that could qualify.
If they're viable for certification, they have been. Okay, so that's going to happen as well. All right, thank you.
Ron, thank you very much. And I started earlier to introduce Dr. Chris Pearson. He's from the firm of Lewis & Rocha, who's kindly hosting us, as they often do, and had a career in industry as a techie, and went from that to being an attorney, specializing in cybersecurity, homeland security, intellectual property, privacy, and other matters. So we've asked him to come in today and give us some perspective on national issues and initiatives. That will be complemented a little later in the program by Corey Miller of the AEA and some national tech policy issues. So, Dr. Pearson.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully, got this on so everyone can hear me, and everyone that's joining us by teleconference can also hear me. I see a lot of very familiar faces. What we're going to do today is Mark asked me if I could kind of do a two-part, a little bit of information on what's happening here at the state level, and some things that are happening in D.C. on the federal level. Mostly all that I talk about today is going to be homeland security related on the cybersecurity high-tech side. I am going to talk a little bit about a few other state initiatives. First, I know Chris Comiskey was here earlier today. I've been part of a three-year program working with him and on the IT Security Advisory Council for the state of Arizona, really pushing forward some of these security implementation privacy matters. Part of that, part of what he talked about today was the State Information Security and Privacy Office and that legislation. It's, of course, going to be pushed out, and I'm sure there will be some hearings on it. I have it listed as SB 1104, something that he talked about, and certainly you should take a look at with keen interest. There are 78% of the different states throughout the United States have either chief information security office positions or state information security officer positions, either way, same thing, that serve either under the CIO or in varying capacities. Arizona does not. I personally look at this position purely as a facilitator, not necessarily as a full-blown implementer in terms of implementing everything throughout the state. We have CIOs and CISOs at all the major, all the 30 different major departments out of the whole 130, so that's kind of not necessary. But it is necessary to get someone in there to facilitate these things from top-down level. So I do recommend that you take a look at that. One thing I wanted to talk about real quickly, I'm not sure if Corey's going to talk about it. Hopefully I don't step on our toes if she is. In 2003, or 2002, there was a data breach, of course, in California, 200,000 person information. State employees was released, was breached. They didn't know about it. They said, hey, all we want to do is find out about this type of thing. And, of course, Feinstein and Boxer went ahead and sponsored SB 1386, went into effect July 1, 2003 in California. That's a data breach bill, i.e. we had a breach, we're notifying you about it, take steps and measures to go ahead and protect your information. We actually, I had the pleasure of working the first case in the country, SB 1386 case that actually turned out to be a mafia extortion, data extortion ransom. From there, things kind of just snowballed. Luckily, I set up the cybersecurity practice group ahead of that, not in response to that, which worked out very good for business, not so well for my sleep. But since that point in time, 34 different states have gone ahead and enacted similar legislation. Finally, last year, with the last session, Arizona got its own data breach bill, went into effect January 1 of this year. So January 1, Arizona has its own data breach bill. It does have a sunset provision in the event that federal legislation is passed, which I will talk about in a little while, that bill will close shop. ARS, it's actually SB 1338-1338, and it's enacted as ARS 447501. Interesting piece of legislation, something that was heavily lobbied, something that we should, as businesses and all the rest, keep our eyes on. Two other things are really quickly, Arizona. Some of you actually have been sending me emails, either making in fun of me on TV or over the radio for talking too quickly, which I, of course, never do. But I was talking last week about how Arizona is number one again. I do have the T-shirts outside. They're $10.95 each. Arizona, it says Arizona number one on the back for identity theft 4 years in a row. So you can buy them cash only. We're number four. And that was a joke. It's about as good as you get from a lawyer. For the fourth year in a row, we're number one. There's no legislation behind this. This is just a think about this as we move on. California, fifth largest gross national product in the world. We beat them out 4 years ago, and we're still going strong. Top three states the past 2 years, Nevada, California, Arizona, Southwest, we have a problem. Think about it as we move forward. It is a high-tech issue, of course. Out of the bank fraud nationally and in Arizona, a lot of it was electronic fraud transfer. So we're talking about all those high-tech phishing and ID theft issues. Homeland Security here in the state of Arizona, last year legislation was enacted. Prior to that point in time, the Homeland Security was in office. It's actually by executive decree, Governor Politano went ahead and passed Frank Navarette, with who was currently serving as the director of DEMA, the Department of Emergency Management, with the task of kind of wearing two hats. It actually had no legislative authority. It was just an executive order. Last year that changed, and the legislation passed that created a Department of Homeland Security. I think it was 90 days, 60 days after the session ended, September 21, I believe, of 2006, when the actual changeover occurred. Something that has implications, of course, as we now make that its own directorship in terms of funding grants and monies and all the rest. Director Navarette has left the position, and Lisa Behrens-Morrison from Department of Liquor, who did a lot with kind of ID theft task force and things of that nature, is now the director of security or the Department of Homeland Security. So it's kind of just a little local knowledge on homeland there. In terms of monetary funding, monetary funding in the state of Arizona, in terms of UOSI money, meaning that is given to the local cities, of Phoenix, of course, being the major one with the airport within our boundary and under police control here, has actually decreased to a huge degree. So that's something to kind of look at over the next year. DHS funding has really been cut strong for our area. Top off, which the next exercise is held every few years. Top off 3 was held in Connecticut, but it involved tri-state area. Multiple states, multiple countries participated in that exercise. Top off 4 was supposed to be here in 2000. Actually, it was supposed to be here right now, actually in a month or two. It's been delayed until about October. I can't tell you whether or not it will be here. That's just kind of up to higher powers than they. But that event was going to be a 3-day event, turned into a 10-day mock disaster scenario event. Something to keep abreast of, especially as the Super Bowl, there's going to be a lot of ramp up in terms of tabletops and practices regarding federal. We're going to go through a lot of different things. First and foremost, the position that was created 1 year prior to this past May, so May 2005. Bush had created and Chertoff allotted a position for kind of the cybersecurity czar, not housed under the White House, not housed as a not housed further up the food chain, so to speak, but an assistant secretary. That position actually sits under George Forsman, the undersecretary for preparedness, and under his deputy Robert Zitz. That individual that has been appointed a year after the position was created, Greg Garcia, who had a IT lobby association out of California. He actually got on the ground in November and is now in full swing as the assistant secretary for what is called cyber and telecommunications. So Chertoff down to Jackson, down to Forsman, to Zitz, to Garcia is where the kind of the food chart goes. Under Greg are two different branches. Didn't used to be this way. It's changed actually for the better. Something I was behind. We have something called National Communication System, NCS. That is actually the branch of the government that communicates to the populace, to the federal institutions in the event of an emergency, and kind of coordinates everything. And then we have the National Cybersecurity Division, NCSD. NCSD was under an acting director for about a year and a half after Amit Yoren left. Those two organizations now are both jointly under Garcia, which is a change for the better, so that in the event of a calamity, in the event of a disruption, in the event that something breaks, so to speak, the response and the reconstitution of the network of those types of things will be done jointly by the group that proactively is set up with and charged with protecting that, and reactively communicating out the message to everyone that needs to know. That's going to be some substantial changes. National Infrastructure Protection Plan, NIPP. How many people are actually familiar with that? Is there anyone? Okay. Its final version came out last year. Actually, quite a few of us in Arizona helped write certain sections of it. The NIPP is done. It's out there. You can get it for yourself. What isn't done is the sector-specific plans, the SFPs. Those are actually due in Thanksgiving. They're not done. No better way to say it than that. They're not done. That is actually how you implement the NIPP. That does cause some concern. We'll have to look and see what happens in future months with the sector-specific plan as we go forward. IT, of course, there being 13 critical infrastructures, IT and telecom being one of them, but also kind of the spoke that connects all the different wheels of all the other 13 critical infrastructures. Legislation, Safety Act, the Support for Anti-Terrorism by Fostering Effective Technologies Act. Safety Act was enacted in 2002. It's really meant as a means to channel money and funding through an R&D development process, a way really to take advantage of dual-use technology. So something that a private sector has done or created or made, and take that and channel it through for a law enforcement or a homeland security purpose. That act, passed and it's been in place. You can have arguments and debates over how successful it has or has not been. With that said, the House just announced last week, in the House Subcommittee on Homeland Security, they've announced last week that they are going to push forward new legislation, new amendments to that, because the process isn't working as well as it should.
Now, could you move a little closer to the mic?
Certainly. Everyone can hear me in here, I know, right? Good. So that isn't actually, the R&D process isn't working as it really should right now, and hopefully those changes go ahead and fix that. Like I said, I haven't seen an actual copy of the legislation that has been posted yet. I'm sure there's a pre-slip copy out there if you're interested. 2006 August, the Council of Europe, the ratification of the Convention on Cybercrime. Corey, are you going to talk about this? No? Okay. This has been an ongoing project for, I can't even tell you how long, 7, 8 years. And really, it's been kind of a hard process in terms of the United States not wanting to sign off on this document. We went ahead and signed off on the documents. The only problem is that we haven't really thought about the privacy implications piece. But we'll figure that out later after the fact. What this basically does is it sets forth some norms and some means of communication between the United States and other countries. Especially what we did is try getting those countries in where a lot of the cyber threats are coming from, so we have similar baseline laws in the Philippines, in South Korea, in East Asia, in these different countries. So that when we identify the roving bands of, kind of loosely affiliated criminal syndicates out there, we can actually work with local and law enforcement out there and bring about some remediation for those criminal acts. Figures came out last year out of the $1 billion budget, $20 million, and $1 billion budget for Homeland Security. $20 million were spent on cyber R&D. I guess I would follow that up by we hope that that number increases. We hope that the budget for NCSD and what is under Greg Garcia increases. I'm not really holding my breath, to be quite honest. Cyber events, Homeland Security, Cyberstorm 1, which was supposed to take place in 2003, took place in 2005. There was a public report released on it last year. You can pick it up and read it for yourself, the unclassified version. Cyberstorm 2 was announced, and that will take place approximately 1 year from now. So we'll see what that brings. Once again, it's a large tabletop / real world cyber security exercise out of NCSD. I told you I'd get back the data breach bill, federal. For everyone that's heard me speak since 2003, when the first federal piece of legislation was pushed through by Feinstein, I'm still saying that there is federal legislation that is in the House, in the Senate, it's been everywhere. We would have thought that choice point card systems would have kind of lit a fire under certain people to get a federal legislation passed as opposed to doing a piecemeal 34-state data breach bill. I think I'll still be talking about federal legislation next year if you want to tune in, because quite honestly, I don't see a change, especially last year with the VA, with Veterans Administration, and that should have queued up something and hasn't, and of course, the breaches occurred there as well. And then finally, one piece, the CISA, the Cybersecurity Industry Alliance. Does anyone read any of, no? DC Lobby Group used to be run by Paul Kurtz. Paul actually stepped down He stepped down as of about 2007, approximately. He stepped down, and Liz Gasser, who used to be the general counsel for CISA, has moved in. CISA, they actually do a lot in terms of federal legislation. It's a high-tech lobbying group, but it's about 3 years old. They actually put out a lot of good white papers. They work some with the Business Security Roundtable Art Crovello has really kind of spearheaded. They work a lot. They're on a lot of the different industry reports. I merely put that information out there so that if you haven't read anything on there, that you do go ahead and read that information. Or if you do know the organization, you know that there is going to be kind of a transition in between Paul, who really pushed things quite far ahead. And that is all that I have. Does anyone have any questions? Yes. Sorry. Okay.
Considering technology has advanced so much since 9/11, why do we keep getting these reports that states and the national government aren't really making a great deal of progress toward bettering our situation?
The question is that since a lot of time has, since technology has increased and progressed more since 9/11, why aren't we really on top of these issues? It basically comes down to communication problems. When we look at government, traditional models of government in terms of critical infrastructure, we have a hub and a spoke model. Your traditional federal government spokes out in terms of private and state and all the sectors. The only problem is that we still think of the 13 critical infrastructures as 13 different hubs sitting on a piece of paper, each individual, chemical, transportation, water, energy, IT, defense. They're all there, and they're all these hubs and spokes. What we need to do, and what hasn't happened at the highest levels of government, is gotten an understanding that these aren't flat, that if you pick those spokes and wheels and hubs up, and there is one that is IT. It's all IT. The whole thing is IT telecom. But the rod that really connects all of them, so you can three-dimensionally picture it, the rod that collects all of them, is cyber. It is IT. Dams, controlled by SCADA systems, supervisory control and data acquisition systems. Energy sector, it's all SCADA systems. So you have a lot of SCADA systems, a lot of control mechanisms, PCS types of systems that control the backbones of our infrastructure. They're old, they're outdated, they're freely available because there's no export restrictions on them. I'll give an example, Bin Laden's father, do you know what his job was? Yeah, he's an engineer. What did he build? What did Bin Laden's father build? He built dams. One of the things he did was build dams. Laptops in Iraq have been recovered with what type of diagrams on them? Not your question. Dams. What type of SCADA systems have been found on those laptops? Not your question again.
Dams.
Dams SCADA systems. We have a lack of an ability at the highest level to communicate down to everyone that even though IT is a wheel, a hub and a spoke, that IT is also the media. It's the means by which everything gets done. Banks, ATMs, think about it now. You write a check, immediately overnight you're going to get an electronic wire transfer. You don't have 5 days to go, you know, deposit money back into it. It's all ones and zeros flowing around. As a result, if you take down that medium, forget about, you know, taking down a physical building, you know, an Intel or a Microsoft or a, yeah, that would set us way back in terms of tech and development. But if you take down the medium, the means of the communication, if you disrupt that, i.e. what happened 2 weeks ago with a repeat of what happened 3 years ago, attacking some of the 13 critical DNS routers that really run the Internet. If you do that, you're going to have physical repercussions. You're also going to have potential loss of life repercussions. And what we haven't done as government is actually communicate those within federal government, down to state government, and actually done something about it. Why do I think personally it hasn't been done?
Not sure we have enough time for that.
I mean, really quickly, it hasn't been done because there is no leader that's not from tech who's been pulled out to be that interface, because those individuals are going to cycle back into tech, and you actually can't go about and bring meaningful change if you're going to return to the environment that you're kind of going back to tech.
Chris, would you, we're kind of running out of time, but close with explaining a little about the local InfraGuard chapter that you lead and for whom that's appropriate and how people can get involved?
Yeah, there's a, InfraGuard is an organization established by the FBI about 10 years ago. Actually, I just finished my term of one of the many, hopefully I'll be able to get at least an hour of sleep a night now. InfraGuard here in Arizona is a very strong chapter, about 420 members strong. They're all secured by the FBI along the different 13 critical infrastructures to provide information intelligence to the FBI and also get bidirectional information and feedback from there. If you're interested, you can go to phoenixinfraguard.net. I do want to take just one more question before I run upstairs. Go ahead, real quick.
Sure. The scope of your cybersecurity include resilience to nuclear devices?
The only systems within our government that are set up to withstand electromagnetic pulse are going to be those that are military-hardened systems, and not all those are actually set up to withstand that. On the corporate side, there is no return on investment for an EMP, not necessarily generated from an actual nuclear device exploding. We do know that there are devices that can generate EMPs without nuclear fallout and all those. There are very, very few places in the United States that have actually taken those measures. There is testimony before Congress in 2005. You can go look it up. There's a gentleman who discusses a mock attack from a fishing vessel or a barge vessel off the coast of California, and the fact that if you're at the outer limits of the Coast Guard reach, what impact that has on our favorite Palo Alto, Silicon Valley area. But it has not been addressed at all.
So if you still have tube radio transceivers, save them. Thank you, Dr. Pearson, for coming downstairs and for hosting us here. Appreciate it. And next up, Corey Miller, the director of AEA. Do they American Electronic Association? I know people have trouble losing that mnemonic. Let's mic you up. This one here. Corey's long been involved in our Arizona technology community and headed AEA Arizona for 3 or 4 years now? Almost 5 years now, so she's going to give us some additional perspective on technology industry policy issues. Corey, thank you.
Am I on? I only represent technology companies.
There you go.
Perfect. Hi, everyone. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me. Wanted to give you a quick overview for who AEA is if you aren't familiar with the association. As Mark mentioned, we are formerly the American Electronics Association. It was founded almost 65 years ago by David Packard of Hewlett & Packard. We are the largest and oldest high-tech trade association in the world. We have presence across the country, 17 local grassroots offices, if you will, Arizona being one of them. Presence, split headquarters between Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley, California, and international presence in Beijing and Brussels. All said, we represent about 1.8 million high-tech professionals, and we kind of have this identity crisis that go back and forth. We rebranded AEA, the little Internet E, but then you'll always see in any print documentation, formerly the American Electronics Association. So it is all high technology represented in that membership. So it's obviously electronics, hardware, software, semiconductors, medical devices, components, biotech has now been admitted into membership. So we do represent all sectors of the high-tech industry. I wanted to go through and share with you, because we have policy wonks on the Hill in D.C. who love to have the chance to vicariously, even if it's just that, pontificate about the atmosphere and how things are in Washington, D.C., and what we're forward-looking now with this new shift in terms of leadership. Just throw out some numbers for you. The House of Representatives now, there's 233 Dems as opposed to in 2006 there were 202. The Senate went from 45 Dems to 51 Democrats. And an interesting statistic is that no sitting Democrat lost an election in this past election. So some atmospheric. We're seeing it, obviously, if you watch the news, you can't get away from it. The Democrats are being very assertive. The Republicans, it's interesting, the sentimentality on the Hill is there's somewhat of an identity crisis. And they're attributing that because 70% of the Republicans that are actually serving now have never been in the minority. They kind of don't really know how to deal with this. It's slightly more civilized, but not much. And Majority Leader Reid and Minority Leader McConnell actually seem to like each other. It would be interesting to see how that plays out. What's happened since Nancy Pelosi did obviously get her 100-hour agenda passed, but now the question is how much will actually go into law. Surprisingly, there were a large number of Republicans who voted with the Democrats on the agenda. Examples of that are 124 Republicans voted with the Dems on cutting student loans, 82 Republicans joined the Dems on minimum wage increases, and 62 was the average number of Republicans voting for the six bills on the 100-hour agenda. Trade, obviously we're going to see some shifts there. We're already starting to see that with more Democratic control, free trade. We're seeing changes, and we'll have to keep monitoring that. What are we anticipating? Obviously, Iraq is going to be a big, big topic and continue to be an area of contention for a lot of folks. Pelosi is fortunately committed to raising competitiveness bills probably in March. AEA has done a phenomenal job. But 2 years ago, we actually met with both sides of the aisle, with Democrats and the Republicans, and helped to come up with their competitive agenda, competitiveness. Pelosi continues to be very close to our D.C. office. In fact, she was last night she was here at ASU. She was talking about the cuts for student loans, which I thought was interesting. So it'll be nice if Arizona starts to get some much-needed federal attention and quit being a donor state and all those things that we whine and complain about so much. Energy dependence is also going to be a big issue, and again, that's going to reach across the aisle for both sides. Oversight is going to be a big issue. And it does appear, though, that Pelosi and Reid are not going to push the typical liberal agenda. We're not seeing a lot of that. So it's interesting, and again, we'll just have to see how this plays out. In terms of technology-specific initiatives, we're expecting that we're going to see a lot of issues that were left on the table when the Dems had control in 2002, but have been simmering, kind of have been around. Of particular interest for AEA members, Representative Markey will take the top spot at the with the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee, so which obviously has oversight for telecommunications and the Internet. So having jurisdiction over telecom and Internet high-tech issues, such as privacy and net neutrality, I think will finally really move to the forefront and get some attention. I'm going to go through just some of the issues and who are players in the federal space we're monitoring. Digital copyright. Digital rights management. This was a really hot issue a couple years ago, kind of settled down. But as we all know, Hollywood tends to be very democratic in its political orientation. So again, we're anticipating more legislation mandating the digital rights management tool coming up. Net neutrality. Representative Markey's elevation, like I said, will create the opportunity for net neutrality's return, meaning more headaches for telephone and cable giants who want regulatory relief. AEA, this was an issue that sometimes being a national trade association and having people on both sides, sometimes I tease and we kind of wimp out a little bit and say, yeah, we're not picking a side on this one. We actually did, and we support the principles of net neutrality. which makes for some really interesting board meetings. Marky supports the net neutrality, as does Nancy Pelosi. Privacy. Again, Markey has been a zealous champion of consumer privacy rights as the incoming chair of the powerful subcommittee that oversees online business practices. I'm sure we're going to see more vigorous activity start to crop up there. In the past, Markey complained about privacy concerns in computer chips and tried to force websites to delete information about visitors. He also attacked prominent ISPs after they disclosed user search histories and asserted that increasing privacy laws are necessary. It's safe to say that these issues will get significant airplay in the congressional upcoming session. I'm trying to go through these because I know this is so exciting. Trying to give you snippets here. Tax policy and the U.S. Congress. It's interesting. Since the November election, the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charles Rangel has discussed his first priority for the new Congress, and he really wants to foster this tone and atmosphere of bipartisanship. And he's even made the comment that the first bill gets passed will be passed unanimously. Also part of the tax issue is fiscal responsibility. The Dems in the House and Senate have promised to reinstate the pay-as-you-go rules, meaning that if there's a tax break, it's going to be offset by a way to recover and recuperate that lost tax dollars. The agenda, top line, no tax increases. Both Rangel and Baucus have made it clear that they will not attempt to repeal Bush's tax cuts from 2001 and 2003 that are set to expire in 2010. But that said, Rangel has also indicated that when it comes to evaluating tax code, all provisions are on the table for consideration. Some of the other tax issues is the alternative minimum tax. Does anybody want me to go into what that is? The R&D tax credit. Painful as it is to say, it took almost a year to get another one-year extension. But again, this is one of those that's so highly important for U.S. competitiveness. And Rangel wants to make it permanent. Pelosi has talked about making it permanent. So I think this is probably one of our best shots of actually getting that extended permanently. Foreign tax policy also, I think there's concern with a lot of the offshore outsourcing companies, around, again, with Sarbanes-Oxley, incentivizing and can have companies want to headquarter offshore versus in the U.S. So they're taking a look at international taxation issues and how competitiveness is impacted and rules changes that might need to happen. As far as tech policy for AEA, some of our top agendas, both at the federal level and at the state level, we have, like I said, 17 councils across the country. And kind of the interesting thing about being part of a national trade association that has presence in 17 states and represents, like I have Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada, we have lobbyists, we have in-house lobbyists that work for us. But it allows us to kind of learn from previous mistakes, get access to model legislation, help to build consensus and bring stakeholders together. So in some of these states, obviously California on the RFID issue has been difficult. A lot of that's the ACLU and privacy and human rights crisis and, you know, the fear tactics that come into play. But we are advocating to promote good technical policy, understanding the promises of RFID technology. Within Congress, there's various administrative agencies in the tech community that are engaging in this. A couple of those are the Senate RFID Caucus and the RFID Technology Council. We want to oppose state bans and encourage best practices. Some of those state bans have been in California, Massachusetts, Washington, New Hampshire, New York, New Mexico, Illinois. We are actually instrumental in defeating that ban in the New Mexico legislature about a year and a half ago. Federal programs and initiatives, Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, and Real ID. On the tech policy side, privacy and security, big topics for AEA. Again, the national presence, we're able to work with Google, eBay, Yahoo, Microsoft, Cisco. I mean, we all kind of come together and kind of put our heads together and come up with ways to, in the security breach and privacy security, our whole mantra is don't penalize the technology, penalize the wrongdoer. So don't do these mandates that could impact the ability of technology to function and do everything that it can. Go back and go after the wrongdoer. So under that privacy and security, we're constantly watching and monitoring spyware, security breach, spam, phishing, online privacy, children's online safety, and the social networking. We've all heard all the fun stuff that's going on with internet dating. When I got into this world, I did not think crossover and fun things like deal. On the broadband deployment side, obviously municipal broadband, big area of concern. Again, now this is one of the issues that AEA has chosen to go neutral on. We have some member companies that propose for state governments to be able to offer broadband service, and we absolutely have to stay out. It's a private industry job. So that's one that we just acknowledge and monitor and keep people apprised of current developments. And then network neutrality, obviously we do support that, and that's protecting the consumer's right to use the high-tech equipment and services of their choice, broadband networks, and telecom cable efforts to extract rent from bandwidth hogs. I love it sometimes, my policy guys, when they give me stuff, I'm like, do you really write it that way? I have some federal bills right now that are I thought were somewhat interesting. For CPNI, Chairman Dingell introduced a bill that's actually been named H.R. 936, and it's the Prevention of Fraudulent Access to Phone Records. And basically what he's trying to do there is get Section 222 from the CPNI requirements to two-way and one-way interconnected VoIP providers. So the same security that applies would have to now apply to VoIP providers. There's SB 92, and that's Senator Stevens' CPNI bill that would restrict the ability of telecom carriers to share customers' personally identifiable information or customary proprietary network information in telecom. They do try to dumb this down for recently. There's H.R. 852, which was introduced by Congressman Inslee, that would expand the current prohibitions on pretexting and other sharing of customer information to voice over IP providers. And again, the net neutrality, the latest one is S-215. And again, our sentimentality is that we think that it has a better chance of passing this year, given the makeup of the Senate and Ed Markey. And so it'll be interesting to kind of keep an eye on that and see how that progresses. Again, to kind of reiterate what Chris shared with you too, security breach legislation is unlikely given, and just rethink because of the number of so many committees that are involved in the process. So, any questions?
Yes. You seem to have a...
Oh, what's happening with the offshoring of jobs? I understand that many companies can get a tax credit for offshoring jobs, and I think they were trying to deter or at least work with that in some way to influence the decreasing of offshoring.
I think there are so many parts that play into tech companies doing offshoring of jobs. A lot of times, too, you know, we kind of have with Congress, they do this Benedict Arnold of high-tech companies and how dare you take companies offline. But if you really look at, there needs to be a lot more done, I guess, is what the thought is, other than just, you know, bits and pieces, but the Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, it's the cost of doing business in the United States. You get to health care. I mean, the cost of doing business, regulatory and insurance. And so there's a whole broad range of things that we're looking at that contribute to that. So I don't have a definitive answer for you on that, but our website does actually go into some of the offshore outsourcing issues.
And that web URL is?
AEANet.org.
And we are capturing minutes, and we'll put them up with all of this, some of the bills and links and so on. But we probably do need to wrap. Corey, great overview of, I know, a vast array of things going on. So thank you for the heads up.
There are a lot of resources on the AEA website. And if they're all downloadable for anybody to go into the community,
great too. And if you'll relinquish your – oh, you did relinquish your microphone. I'll have Dr. Craver attach that while I introduce him. I first met Ted in – thank you, Corey. I first met Ted Craver in the early 90s when I went into private practice, and I called my old friend Alan Held of MicroAge and said, well, what's happening in tech policy? He said, you need to talk to Ted. and G-Speed was coming on strong then, a cluster-based economic development foundation. Ted was in part helping facilitate the predecessor organization to this. AICI became its first chair, and then later we kind of returned the favor and spun out an e-learning committee that became Gazelle and now ESATS. A big win in legislative committee yesterday, and I know you'll talk about that. And then Steve will close with, I know you'll want a couple of minutes to talk about our summit. So, Ted.
Very good. Is this mic on? Wasn't turned off. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? All right. Okay, use the mic. Okay, fine.
Yeah, that's better, Ted.
Yeah,
I have a lavalier. Whatever they call it. About 15 years ago, a bunch of us, some of us in this room, had a quaint notion that we took a look at all these wonderful industries out here, the aerospace, healthcare, transportation, telecommunications, and technology was just driving the hell out of these industries. They're advancing at a great rate. And then we were taking a look and we found one industry that seemed to be lagging a bit, called education. And why wasn't? And we knew there were a few computers in the back of the classroom and a few computers in the computer labs, but that was about it, maybe $100 a teacher for training. And so we decided, well, we'll do something about this. And we created something called the Arizona Software Association, okay, something called the Arizona Telecommunication Information Council, and a bunch of predecessors to that, and the Phoenix Futures Forum, and the A-Speed process. And that went forward for a few years. And again, there was a couple of computers in the back of the classroom. There was a bunch of computers in the computer labs. And that was about it. So anyway, said, well, we got to attack this directly. We'll create an organization called the Arizona Learning Technology Partnership. And we did a strategic plan. Now, once we did a strategic plan, we figured something would change. Well, 2 or 3 years later, there were still a couple of computers in the back of the classroom. And teachers had a little bit of training. And that was about it. We went to the Arizona Legislature.
Ted, we can't hear you very well.
We went to the legislature. Maybe this is not. I don't know. People just automatically turn it off when they take it off or something.
Yes, it is. No, it's on.
It's on. Light. Okay. Anyway, I'll just hold this. How's this, Steve?
Yes.
All right. So anyway, we went to the legislature and said, we've got this magnificent strategic plan. Let's put in legislation. Well, nothing happened. But all of a sudden, two words showed up. One was the word technology, one was the word equipment, in Students First, which became part of the School Facilities Board. And they went out and put one computer for every 8 students throughout the land and also wired all the schools. But there was, again, most of those were in the labs and back of the classrooms. There was no teacher professional development. And there was things known as the no last mile gaps, this sort of thing, because all it was really was land systems within the schools and connected maybe the district office. Well, we said, well, that didn't work, so let's try creating an industry association. We created Gazelle, the e-learning industry association, and one of the largest software companies in the world that deals with K-12 education. And then that we basically that was good in itself. We decided let's go back once more into the breach for the K-12 education. So we created something called ESAT, e-learning system for Arizona's teachers and students. And we said, what can we do now that's different? And being an aerospace engineer, I said, let's make a design. I mean, if the planning doesn't work, let's try to design something. So we created this grand design for e-learning statewide. And what we came up with was a yes, you do. Basically, you just basically got to do we got to find – we want the master's life. We want normal. Where's normal?
Let me just as housekeeping. You can have your parking validated.
Where's normal on this? Yeah. So we need to find normal. View something here. There we go. Now we know view slideshow. Okay. Yeah, view slideshow. Son of a gun. Where's that?
There.
All right. Son of a gun. View slideshow. That's novel. Okay. So we came up with this design, and we said, well, what do we got it? The design is really fine, and it has all these good things in it. But we really have to start the design, finding out what we have to do, and what we have to do is really transform an industry. We've gone so long with very little technology. This is now just not an incremental improvement of the industry.
as all the other ones have, this is going to be transforming the industry, sort of like when they came with jet engines versus their old prop engines and bamboo airplanes. So we decided, what did the industry look like for the last 5,000, 10,000 years? And it turns out that writing and then lectures created by Roman soldiers lecturing their troops, paper was invented, the printing press was invented, the Prussians invented what we now know as the classroom back in about 300 or 400 years ago, and that, of course, hasn't changed much. And so let's call this a transformation and not just an innovation. We talked about some of this, but oops, where am I going? Here we go. What we focused on our design is the student-teacher's nexus. We said the learning takes place with the student and the teacher. We need to free the teacher to teach. We need to free the student for interactive learning. This means we have to focus on areas of digital curriculum and professional development. That what sort of led our design into the digital curriculum, teacher, staff, professional development. We decided the transformation area was the e-learning schools. And then, oh, by the way, we do need computers and broadband and all this stuff. Then we took a look out there and found out what is happening in education initiatives in Arizona. There's got to be some e-learning in there somewhere. Well, you look at practically all of these, and it's basically still trying to enhance what we've known as legacy education, which is basically lecture, seat work, and recitation. So we took all of these and put them into a system, and we said, what does this system really do for the student? Well, it just blows the devil out of academic performance. You get a right e-learning system, one-to-one computing with the correct digital curriculum and a fully trained teacher. A lot of this research comes with the Office of Secretary of Defense. They've done these studies with their dependency schools worldwide, plus all of other meta-studies. And it finds out that the average, no grade, forget about grade inflation, forget about social promotion, the typical bell-shaped curve have half the kids below average, right? That's just normative statistics. When you put them in an e-learning program, frankly, it not only moves the center of the bell-shaped curve from maybe a C up to a B, it pulls in the tail because it really deals effectively with kids on either end of it. So our ESAS design, which came in 2003, says we've got to build an intellectual infrastructure with some institutes for digital curriculum, teachers, and this sort of thing. Broadband, you heard about that, internet to all schools, e-learning pilot-centered schools, and then start transforming school by school. 2 years ago, we went in and created this magnificent bill that did all of this. We asked for $140 million to start it out. It got in the Senate Education Committee. It stayed in the Education Committee and Senate. It stayed there, and it ended. It ended with doing nothing. This prior year, 2006, Senator Bennett came to the Celebration of Innovation put on by ATC, said, hey, let's have an e-learning bill. I want to get kids, get this thing going. And what we wound up with was a middle school math pilot for about 10,000, actually going to be about 4,000 or 5,000 kids in 10 schools. $3 million, a data warehouse bump at the Department of Education. But the critical aspect, for the first time, I think in any state, although I don't know that because I haven't looked at all the states, but I think we're about any states, there's a policy now in legislature that says we're having a 10-year task force. Now, task force, 10 years. Normally task force is you want to get the job done, right? Well, this job's going to take 10 years. And so then in infinite wisdom, they create a 10-year task force, plus policy that tells that task force something to do, says basically we want e-learning one-to-one for all kids in Arizona. We got 10 years to do it. That's implied. This year we did a lot of work this summer. Representative Anderson came to us, and we had a nice little some coffee over in Mesa. And he says, I've seen the light. I went to Washington. They told me what you've been telling me, Ted, for 3 or 4 years at one of my legislative conventions there. Came back here, and he put a working group together with some really all-star people on it, from Mike Smith, the lobbyist, to Carol Peck from the Rodel Foundation and Department of Education, came up with a bill. And during that time, we pulled together a team of lobbyists and influence folks. And what the bill is right now that was dropped in education, dropped and then heard in Education Committee on Wednesday, was a House Bill 2742. Well, schools apply to the U.S. Department of Education for grants to transform school by school by school to this system. Because you see here, and again, probably one of the first times ever in legislation, they don't lead with hardware or laptops or let's do some system in the state to collect data and administrate all the administrative software. They're saying these words are in here: digital curriculum, software for the teacher, computer hardware, technical support, data lands with file servers and broadband connectivity. Basically, they want to assure over the years that it grows to one computer per student, and with GITA standards and basic training of all teachers, instructional classroom application, not how to use the darn computer, but how do you instruct with it? How do you teach with it? We're incredibly excited about this bill. It's unique. $10 million for a million kids, 10 bucks a kid. Not much. But the thing is, we got a bucket out there, a very nice one, that over the years we can start influencing the governor, influence the legislature, say, well, let's bump this to $100 million. So now we got $100 a kid. That means we can transform maybe 5 or 10% of the schools, and then $2 million. As you work up, you find out that with our system design, remember I mentioned the system design in 2003? We found we could do the cost of a whole rollout for this for all kids, from going from a million to a million four kids over 10 years, but also come up with cost savings. And there's significant cost savings when we do e-learning. You do mastery learning. The students graduate earlier. You don't have to pay for those couple of high school years out there. Huge cost savings. You don't have to build all the schools. Huge cost savings. Efficiency and effectiveness, which we find in every other industry based to adopting technology. You invest first, and then you get huge payoffs at the back end of it. So you were going to be spending $96 billion over the next 10 years in Arizona. That's a given with what we're spending right now. It ain't going to change much. But all you do is spend an extra $2 billion for e-learning. That's about $2,000 a student, of a million students now, and it's going to actually be less than that, because the cost savings kick in towards the tail end of it. You can get the whole system transformed. Department of Education took a look at this design a couple of years ago, and they said no other state's doing anything like this. If you do this, you'll be a leading state. And now what you come to is the fact that you can really deal with the issues that we have to deal with here. First, your academic performance will go to the top five states. Probably will zoom past Massachusetts. Graduation rate will bump up significantly. English language learners learn about a year quicker than normal because of the Rosetta Stone and all the other good stuff out there. I've done some work with DARPA on languages. First 21st century graduates really know what to do it. We have qualified teachers, not only highly qualified, but savvy on how to use e-learning. And because in this financial model, we've given them a 20% raise in salary. That's $10,000 a year on the average through this model. In 10 years from now, over other ages, they'll be making an extra 10 grand a year. So we'll keep them in Arizona. We won't lose them all. And basically all it is that particular amount. Now, the question is, what do we do with this? I've handed out the bill. It's a beautiful bill. One page, one lousy page. I mean, you get a minor amendment sometimes for some little regulation, and it's 14 pages long. The legislators are reading this. They can understand it. They can sort of see where it is. We having a next hearing. It was in education this week. Appropriations next week. Appropriations, there are 15 legislators going to be frowning and wondering where they're going to find $10 million. But we got to go help them out. We got to show them that's really supportive. Anybody you want to get involved with this, there's two things you do. You can either diddy-bop down to the legislature if you hadn't before and sign up at the kiosk down there. Any time of the week, day of the week, just go down there, walk into the House or Senate, sign up at the kiosk, get your password in there, and go home. Now, you probably can't get down there at 1 o'clock and stay till 3 o'clock when the bill's heard on Wednesday afternoon. But you can sit at your desktop and now go into that system and put a request to speak and say, no, I don't want to speak, but I'm for the bill, and this is who I am and why I want to do that. And you do that for the rest of your life without having to troop on down there, the rest of us, and hang out and watch everybody have fun at the legislature. We need your help on this. Anyone wants to get involved that's not already on my mailing list, a bunch of you guys are, email list, just give me your card afterwards and we'll put you on the list. Now, one final thing, I'd like you to take a packet with you. I didn't hand them out, but a couple people have them there. But what's in the packet is our rationale. One is that this is from our national government, National Academy of Sciences. The ATC is pushing this. We've gotten several hundred of these. This is the economic crisis we're facing worldwide, and we're frankly being taken to the cleaners by China and India, this sort of thing, it focuses on education and energy. This Department of Education tells you why e-learning is good, gives you examples and action items, and this is Wilson District, the model for the nation. It has to be north of the airport. It's been doing e-learn for 15 years now, actually 12 years. They've gone from the world's worst district up to the worst district in Arizona, literally, to the highest performing district in the Phoenix Union High School District. And finally, biotech had a roadmap. We took the biotech roadmap, spent an afternoon, took their format, dumped our stuff into it. Now we have a roadmap. So anyways, that's in there. Anyways, that's it. You all come on and have some fun down there at the legislature.
Ted, thank you so much. Steve, are you still on the line?
I am.
Just one moment. I know you want to speak for just a minute or two about – well, you probably want to speak longer, but that's all you get. Let me before I turn it over to Steve Peters in Tucson, who's coordinating a summit for us later this year, thank Lewis and Rocha again for hosting us, Fox Communications for electronically abling our remote outreach. Steve, and finally, to validate your parking, take the elevator up to 19. Before you go down to the basement, and they'll stamp it for you. So, Steve, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, I know it's certainly no secret to the folks who are participating in this meeting that one of the ATIC's priorities over the years has been deployment of broadband to and advanced telecommunication services, particularly to rural and underserved communities around the state. Over the past couple of years, we have identified a number of barriers to deployment, and we have also developed a series of recommendations that we need to address to be able to overcome those barriers. We are now, of course, working hand-in-hand with the Communications Advisory Committee, CIAC, under the Governor's Council on Innovation and Technology in addressing those barriers and those issues. We will be joining, ATIC will be joining with CIAC to address, to host a summit sometime in the May timeframe. We're not sure what time, exactly when that's going to be yet. The purpose of the summit is to bring together high-level decision makers around the state, both public and private, certainly telecom providers and government leaders, local community elected officials, to sit down at the table and for us to see if we can reach consensus on some policies and strategies to address this issue of broadband to the rural and underserved communities. The summit, in addition to having a one-day event, we are planning on having a series of 4 to 5 online meetings prior to that event to provide background updates, to give an overview of what's happening in Arizona, the issues we've been identifying, so that when people come to the summit that we are ready to sit down at the table and actually work on initiatives, plans, policies, and so forth. So we do have a summit committee that has been meeting. We have a meeting coming up tomorrow. If any of you are interested in helping to plan that summit, you're more than welcome to get engaged with us. We have an intranet site. If you get out your pen, I'll give you the intranet site that has the information about the meeting and some background about the summit and where we're heading and our tentative plans. And that website is www.groveSite.com. And again, you'll find the information, an overview about the summit, our tentative plans, and how you can get involved. Or you can contact me at 520-321-1309 or Steve Peters at TucsonLink.org. And I'm done.
Good, Steve. Sorry to hold you to the end on that, but that will be ATIC's most important initiative and program for the year. This year done as a multi-part with some online accessible e-learning presentations and engagement to provide background. I think, as Steve said, last time we did a roundtable, and we spent a lot of that day and a half, 2 days, on the background education. This time we really want to hit the ground with actionable engagement and outcomes. So we're going to move the educational component more in front of it, but also make it asynchronous. So if you can't take it live on the day when it happens, it'll remain available to you. So with that all being said, thank you on behalf of ATIC. Thanks to all